impossible events that God had coordinated. And remember when we did this, we put a big old number on the screen, remember? Anybody remember what it was? 1 to the what?
10 to the Steve,
right. We called it a number because it didn't have a name, so we called it the Steve, and it was 10 to the 157th, right? So 1 followed by 157 zeros is the statistic that it would take in order for one person to fulfill all of the prophecies that were written about him in the Bible, okay? And so it's just astronomical. It's impossible. But we learned that God is the God of the impossible, right? And so God is fully capable of making things that are absolutely outside of the control of humanity to happen so that he can accomplish his purpose and his will. And so from the very beginning of the announcement to the birth of Christ and all the way through to his birth in Bethlehem, all of those things were absolutely unique events. Now today we're going to look at one more piece of those unique events, and that's with the Magi coming. Okay, now I know some of you already might be like squirming in your seats going, the Magi didn't come on Christmas Day. So don't, that's right, don't talk about it like that. Now, I side with that, okay? But I want to catch you, like, as you look at the complexities of the story, but catch this. There are only 4 chapters in the Bible. 4 chapters in the Bible dedicated to the birth narrative of Jesus Christ, his incarnation, okay? That coming. And Matthew, one of the gospel writers, intentionally pairs this story of the Magi with the birth narratives. So it fits very well in it. Now, the reason we say that it's not necessarily that they didn't come at the manger when Jesus was born on Christmas night is because of the word child that we'll see in the text today. So instead of calling him a baby or an infant, they came and visited the child, and they came and visited him in a home, not in the manger, where Luke is very specific that the shepherds went and they found the baby lying in a manger. Okay, so those two pieces help us to go, well, there must have been a time gap between when the Magi come or the wise men come and Jesus's growth, okay, when Jesus was a little bit older, maybe probably a toddler. And based on Herod's response, probably somewhere between birth and 2 years old, okay? So I'm just giving that context. But it's an important story, and it's unique. And so we're going to go ahead and read down through the story for a moment. We'll look at a couple of those pieces that make it unique, and then we're going to look at what it tells us about who Jesus is and what does that mean for us, okay? So we're in Matthew chapter 2. We're going to be reading verses 1 through 16. It may be very familiar. Please don't get glassy-eyed and glazed over as we read it. But watch for those important phrases that pop out of this text. Now, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, in the days of Herod the king, behold, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem, saying, "Where is he who has been born king of the Jews? For we saw his star when it rose, and have come to worship him." When Herod the king heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. And assembling all the chief priests and the scribes of the people, he inquired of them where the Christ was to be born. They told him, "In Bethlehem of Judea, for so it was written by the prophet, 'And you, O Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah. For from you shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel.' Then Herod summoned the wise men secretly and ascertained from them what time the star had appeared. And he sent them to Bethlehem, saying, 'Go and search diligently for the child. And when you have found him, bring me word that I too may come and worship him.' After listening to the king, they went on their way, and behold, the star that they had seen when it rose went before them, until it came to rest over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy." Like, this isn't just, this was nice. I mean, these guys are exuberant. They're with great joy. "And going into the house, they saw the child with Mary, his mother, and fell down and worshipped him. Then opening their treasures, they offered him gifts of gold and frankincense and myrrh. And being warned in a dream not to return to Herod, they departed to their own country in another way. Now, when they had departed, behold, an angel of the Lord had appeared to Joseph in a dream and said, "Rise, take the child and his mother and flee to Egypt and remain there until I tell you, for Herod is about to search for the child and destroy him." He rose, took the child and his mother by night and departed to Egypt and remained there until the death of Herod. This was to fulfill what the Lord had spoken by the prophet, "Out of Egypt I called my son." Just a couple more verses. Then Herod, verse 16, when he saw that he had been tricked by the wise men, became furious. And he sent and killed all the male children in Bethlehem and in all that region who were 2 years old and or under, according to the time that had been ascertained from the wise men. Now, really, it's not the prettiest story when you think about it. We like it. In fact, we decorate our mangers with it, right? We put this nice picture of the wise men coming to visit the baby Jesus, and it reminds us of this story. But when you think about how this story ends, it ends in a gruesome way. It ends in a way that is catastrophic because of Herod and his response to the knowledge that Jesus had been born. And so it's an interesting tale as we look at it, an interesting story that we find within the Bible. And I think it gives us a lot of insight, not only into who Herod was, but it can give us also insight to who we are when we look at Jesus being declared king. So as we look at Matthew chapter 2, I just want to, as we dig into this text today, we're going to look at this idea of what does it mean for Jesus to be king? What does it mean for Herod? What did it mean for the wise men? What does it mean for us today? When we do that, we're going to see a couple different unique things about this text. One, as we look at the unique visit that is, we find that wise men came. The text tells us this: wise men came from the east to Jerusalem. Now, wise men or magi, depending on which translation of the Bible you're reading, would be the term that's used there. And it's referred to a group of men who gathered together to study the stars, to try to interpret the times based on the stars, and try to provide wisdom to those that are around them and guidance to those around them based on what they were gathering from the stars. Now, some of that interpretation of the stars was based on prophecies that were written beforehand, different things that had been given to them to help them to understand who it was. But catch the key here. Wise men came from where? They came from the east. Okay, so the east of Jerusalem would be further pushing into Saudi Arabia and then up north towards to where Babylon was at the time, or Assyria was at the time. At the time of Jesus, Rome had conquered all of that area. But those terms, Babylon and Assyria, are referring to places that had once conquered Jerusalem. These were peoples who had come in and destroyed Jerusalem because of their fear of the God that the people of Jerusalem had obeyed, plus in obedience to God working Israel through his plan of refinement. Okay, and so we have this group of people who lived to the east. Now, we don't know how far east these wise men came from. We tend to think that they came from those areas of Babylon because of the possible connection with Daniel. Now, I'm just going to throw that out there. You can go back and read Daniel, and you can maybe understand how there would be a connection with the knowledge of a king of the Jews coming from some people from the east. But regardless, what makes this really unique is that these guys probably were pagan. These people were not necessarily worshipers of the God of Israel. For sure, even in Israel, there was definitely the worship of the God of Israel had been watered down, okay? And so the understanding of that God that they worshipped in the Old Testament and the time of David and the construction of the temple, or in the time of Moses when God's presence dealt within them, it was a little bit of a watered down version of this worship of God. That's the whole point of why Jesus came. Jesus came to bring back into the world this understanding of what it meant to have the presence of God amongst them and to have God come and save them. And so these wise men, probably pagan, probably they're just looking for some significant event to take place, travel. Now imagine that. They are watching the skies. They see a star. And that's the second part of this unique visit, is the star's announced. The star announces the king's visit. They have some piece of information that tells them that, hey, a king is going to be born, and that king will be the king of Israel. When you see that star, that's significant enough for you to uplift everything that you're doing, stop all that you're doing, and go and search him out. Okay? Based on the information they give Herod, we can understand that it could have taken anywhere from a year to 2 years for them to search this out. Now, in our picture, typically in our picture of that, that's because that seems a little bit odd for us, because we think the star rose, the wise men see it, they load up on camels, and they follow this star all the way to Jerusalem. But that's not what the text says. The text says that the wise men saw the star rise, and then they went to Jerusalem. Why did they go to Jerusalem? Because they knew the star reflected the king of the Jews. Not because the star led them to Jerusalem, but because they saw the star. That sign tells us the king of Jews was going to be born. So let's go to Jerusalem, the capital of Jewish culture. Let's go to where the kingdom of the Jews was centered, and let's go find out about this king that was to be born. Now, we've kind of adapted that story in our own culture, where we show them following the star there. It is true they do follow the star, but not until after they visit Jerusalem. Take a look at it. It says this in verse 8, when he sent them to go search for it. Verse 9, after listening to the king, they went on their way, and behold, okay, that's a key word right there. That's like when behold an angel appears. Behold, something surprising happens. Behold, the star reappears. Okay? Now that's totally unique. That's not something that just happens every single day. We don't have special stars that appear once and then a year later appear again. We talked about this not too long ago, about Halley's Comet, right? Halley's Comet would have maybe been a star that showed up in the heavens prior to all of this knowledge that we have, and been like, wow, and then 85 years later, or whatever it is, it would show up again. Some people even try to explain this star as to be the convergence of planets, right? At this one time, the wise men are watching the sky. In fact, if you watch the Nativity movie, anybody have seen the Nativity movie? That's what they do in that one, is like this, they're watching these three planets converge together. And then all of a sudden, boom, the star, it's really bright. The problem with that is, if that was such a unique event, for it to reappear a year later would mean that it was not that unique. Right? Not the case here. This star that was so unique that gave them the sign that the king of Jews came once. Came on a time, they noticed it. That's an improbable event, right? It's so improbable that who only noticed it? These wise men who came from the east, right? And so then the star comes up, and then the star reappears, and then the star does something very specific. Then the star does what? It rose before them until it came to rest over the place where the child was. At this point, if I'm a wise man, I'm pretty excited about what's happening here, okay? This isn't a UFO thing that's, in fact, did you guys just see that recently? About a week ago out west, there was this big phenomenon that went through the sky. People are like taking pictures, and they're all wondering what this thing is. Okay, that may have been what this had been like momentarily, but it did not come back around, okay? And it, like this did. And can you imagine this big star, however that looked? I can't even fathom it. Again, I hope one day we sit in heaven and can watch on the super IMAX of heaven what all this looked like, right? And it'd be like, Star Wars is so lame. This is cool, right? Because I don't know that we could fully grasp the intensity of what's going on here. The star literally led them from Jerusalem to Bethlehem enough to be able to position them at the home in Bethlehem where the child was. Unique. Right? Okay, not an everyday occurrence. Not something we just are missing every single, every year. Every year the star rises. No. Once. Unique. Okay, so then the next thing that happens is that this child king was living in Bethlehem. Okay, so they knew he was the king of the Jews. They were looking for him. they came to Jerusalem because that's where the king of the Jews should be, is in Jerusalem. They're looking for them, and they're all like, hadn't been a baby born around here in a while. In fact, Herod, if you study Herod, you would recognize that Herod was so intent on preserving his own kingship that he was eliminating his own family. Right? No more children born in my family because they would take my spot as king. All right? And so he's killing his own kids. That's the story of Herod. He's a very wicked, wicked king whose only intent was to preserve his own kingship. Okay? So, and we could see, based on what he was willing to do, he didn't really care about human life. All he cared about was his kingship. So here's this child king. So the wise men show up in Bethlehem. They're like, where's the king? And he's like, if there's been a child that's been born king, I would know about it. I don't know about it. So where's it happening? The chief priests gather together and go, well, he was never meant to be born in Jerusalem. He would have been born in Bethlehem. I guess that'd be a good place to start. So they go there, and he sends them there to go check it out. But imagine that. They show up in Bethlehem, okay? No offense to anybody who lives there, but this would be like showing up in Wheeler, okay? Looking for the President of the United States. Like, right? Kind of looking around, you're like, In fact, if I were wise men, I'd be like strolling into town going, seriously? This is where the star's taking us? Right? And then they go knock on the door. Right, the stars above. I think there's a confirmation this is the right place. Knock on the door, and Dad comes covered in sawdust because he's a carpenter, right? Hello? And there's these guys. I mean, and we don't know that there were three. There's a song about it, so we trust in that, right? We trust in three. We don't know that there were three. There could have been a whole caravan, right? Could have been just a couple. We associate three because of the number of gifts. But regardless, he looks out, and these guys probably aren't, like, dressed like he is, right? They're probably dressed in some royal garb. They've got camels. Evidently, they've got treasures with them, so you can kind of picture this, right? He opens the door. Dude, I think you got the wrong house. Click, right? And they're like, yeah, we think we got the wrong house, too, right? Because this doesn't make sense, and nobody knows. They're here to worship the king of Israel, the king of kings that had been born, and the rest of Bethlehem's going about their business. They don't have a clue. Can you imagine that parade as it comes into town? Is like they watch the wise, because it's not a big town, right? So people are like, did you see that? People, what are they doing here? And all of a sudden, there's Jesus. Totally unnoticed. That's unique. That doesn't happen just by chance, right? Here's God. And then the other thing about this, and I'll just throw this out at you. Mary and Joseph weren't from Bethlehem. Where were they from? Nazareth, 80 miles away. Legitimately, after a year, they could have gone home. She traveled pregnant to Bethlehem. No problem traveling back with a baby, right? Okay? But God, in his great purpose set aside, kept them in Bethlehem. Why? So when the wise men searched out the king of the Jews, they would find him where he was supposed to be born. Not nice. Amazing. Supernatural. God just is just working what he needs to accomplish in order for Jesus to fit the bill for who we need him to be. All right. So in that, there's a few unique events. But the question that I kind of wrestled with throughout this week is, what were they looking for? What were the wise men looking for? And I just want to answer that today by looking at the text. Okay, so Matthew chapter 2, we've covered that a little bit. It says this in verse 2, where is he who has been born king of the Jews? Okay, so the word king here is one that refers to the idea of absolute power and reign. So as they walk into Herod's palace or Herod's territory, they go, hey, where's the one that's been born king of the Jews? And it's not you. Oh, right? Like, you've now just stepped on my toes. If I'm a guy who's totally about my own kingship and protecting my kingship to the point of being willing to eliminate my own family, and you come in and say, where's the guy that's king, and you're not talking about me? That's dangerous territory, right? Now, it causes an issue for Herod, and we'll take a look at that in a moment, but that's what they were looking for. They were looking for the king who would have absolute authority over the Jewish people. They were also looking for a ruler from Bethlehem. So the chief priests and the scribes, they come together and they tell them, hey, where is this child going to be born? And their response is this. Oh, you, O Bethlehem, in verse 6, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah. For from you shall come a ruler. Okay, this is a guide. This is a person who's going to lead the people. They're going to lead. This is going to be the leader of the Jews. And he's going to come from Bethlehem, which is a really small town, a really small portion of the tribe of Judah. And then the other thing they're looking for is someone that's going to shepherd the people. And this reflection goes all the way back to David, who was the shepherd king. Okay, remember when David was anointed king over the people of Israel, where did they find him? He was out in the fields. He was shepherding the flocks, and his dad wouldn't even bring him in. That's because David was the precursor of Jesus, who would be the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. Jonathan talked about that a couple of weeks ago. And so he came to shepherd. This is who they're looking for. And this causes a problem for Herod. Okay? And so check out what the problem it causes for Herod. First of all, it tells us in verse 3, when Herod the king heard this, he was troubled. Okay? And all Jerusalem with him. And so I say, in Herod's heart, fear arose, right? Because these guys just wandered in off the streets and told me that there is a king who's been born who's greater than I am. That generated some fear in his life. Like, what am I going to do about this? How am I going to fix this? What's going to happen to me? What's going to happen to my family? Now, understand this about Herod. Herod was appointed king of the Jews at the time by the Roman government. He was only half Jew himself, and he was not from the lineage of David. So he has no rightful claim to the Jewish throne. And not everybody in the Jewish kingdom knew that, or everybody that would be under his authority. And the idea of him being king, Herod the king, is just an appointment. It's kind of like this, like governor of Michigan versus president of the United States. Okay, and so Herod may have had the title king, but his authority really only involved the territory of Judea, partially Galilee, and then his authority was really only to echo what Rome wanted. So Rome would come in and say, we want the Jews to do this, and Herod, as the appointed representative who was Jewish, he would then take care of Rome's business in view of the Jews. He raised taxes. He was good at building buildings, I guess is what it tells us historically. But he was a wicked, wicked king. Okay, and so, but he wasn't the king of kings. In fact, he didn't have any more authority. He had less authority than Caesar. Caesar could have wiped them out at any point. Okay, remember, because Caesar is the emperor of the empire of Rome. So you have Caesar, Herod. The Jews. Okay? So Herod had some position of authority and he could exercise his authority, but he definitely wasn't the king of kings. And so it created fear to hear that there was a king of kings who had been born. And then we find out that he also does this, is that it reveals in his heart a self-seeking attitude. So what he does is he's like, hey, go find out where this is. Go find out where the child is so I can go worship him. But we learn later that his intent wasn't really to go worship him, right? It was to eliminate him. God warns Mary and Joseph of that. Move the child now. Move Jesus out of Bethlehem because Herod's coming to destroy. Self-seeking. Only reason he wants to destroy is because he's going to remove a threat. This child is a threat to my kingship. I'm out. I got to take him out. So he's self-seeking. He pursues his own ends. And then lastly, there's hostility. Think about what kind of person it would take in order to give the command to kill every baby in the region 2 years old and younger. It's horrible, right? If that happened today, we would respond with full force, right? We would seek to right that wrong. We would fix that injustice. Great hostility. And think about what he's hostile against. His hostility? He finds out that God promised that a king of kings, that his promised king is going to be born in Bethlehem. And he goes, I don't like your plan, God. I'm going to fight against your plan. Imagine that. I've heard God's plan is that the king of kings will be born in Bethlehem. I imagine that must have happened because the wise men tricked me. I'm going to eliminate and fix God's plan so it matches my plan. All because he wanted to preserve his own kingship, his own position. On the flip side, we see the wise men's heart. Okay? We find out they're joyful, right? It tells us in verse 10, when they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. It's that YouTube video where the kid opens the present and he gets exactly what he's been waiting for a really long time. And he's just so going nuts. And we're all like, ah, that's so cute, right? They're like running around so excited because they're about to go see what it is that they've been looking for and searching for. There's great joy. Joyful is probably not even the biggest word. They're like excited that they're going to go get a chance to meet the king. They're going to go meet the King of Kings, the King of Jews. And then they worship him. They bow down. They come before the child, a child, someone 2 years and younger. And they worship him. That's a heart thing. That's a recognition of who this child was meant to be. And they bow down before him and they worship him. And then it tells us that there's acceptance of him. Like, think about this for a second. When they decided, like, that's it. They've come into the house. They see Joseph the carpenter, Mary his mom, and this little 2 year old or younger. And they've like, this is it. This is exactly who God has determined and declared to be the king. And then they go out and get the gifts and they bring them in, right? But like, I might have been walking up to the house going, hey guys, keep everything undercover until we really find out if this is what it is. You know what I'm saying? Because if it's not the right house, we don't want to get their hopes up, right? And you walk in, hey, I got a box of gold for the King of Kings. Oh, that's my child, right? No, it's that idea where it's like, well, maybe. And then once they've, in their hearts, they've accepted that Jesus is who God had determined him to be and declared him to be through the star and through the prophecy and through the star again, that they went, yes, here are our gifts, right? And there are three of them, and we talk about them. The song that we sang earlier gives some symbolism to them. We don't know if that was their intent. It's nice to kind of think about. But the reality is they brought expensive gifts. These were not something that Mary and Joseph probably had. Okay? He probably didn't have a chest full of gold. Probably didn't have expensive perfumes sitting around just going, hey, what are we going to do with these? In fact, I think about it and go, and actually I didn't think about this. Bob Berry thought about this when he was teaching the kids for release time. What do they got to go do immediately after the gifts arrive? They got to leave. Where do they got to go to? Egypt, right? Well, just think about how beneficial expensive gifts would be on a pathway to Egypt, right? It's like, whoo, God just bankrolled our trip, right? And so there's this great, again, just God connecting all that stuff. Okay, so now to the whiteboard, because this is where it comes down to. My question that I began to wrestle with this week is, this is what it was exposed in King Herod's heart, fear, a self-seeking attitude, and hostility, anger, rage, fighting, all that kind of stuff. And then the wise man's heart, a joyfulness, a desire to worship, and a desire to accept or to reveal their acceptance through that. But what about us? We can think about our hearts, right? And this tension that exists when we come face to face with situations where we have to determine how we're going to live in view of Jesus being the king. Because if Jesus is the king, the King of Kings, the Lord of Lords, that means that what he says, I have to do. And where he directs, I have to go. Now, there's tension with that, agreed? Right? My heart starts to experience sometimes that. And I know that. I know that I have that tension. Not just because when Jesus is declared king in my life and I have to come face to face with that. I deal with that with anybody that puts authority over top of me. From the moment I was born. Right? From birth, I resist authority. Why? Paul David Tripp tells us is that it's because we're self-appointed self-sovereigns. Basically, we've made ourselves to be kings in our own world. Fair enough? And until somebody corrects that in our lives, we chase that. Imagine a child, right? Little emperor syndrome, whatever you want to call it. A child that was left untrained to think that life wasn't all about them. As a parent, that's what we spend most of our life doing, right? Is trying to help our children to understand that life, the universe does not revolve around you. But we come into it naturally. Okay, so let me just break this down just a little bit really quick. All right, I hope you can see this. If not, I really apologize. We'll do the best we can. All right, so we have a problem, and that's because we see ourselves as king. Okay. That means we're self-honoring. We like to honor our own wishes, our own desires. Fair enough, right? Okay. We're self-preserving. When situations come along, I'm really hoping I don't spell something wrong and then like get you guys totally off on me all day here. Okay. I want to make sure I don't miss any. We're self-preserving. We come across a situation, we're going to do things that protect our own interests and our own desires. Okay. We're self-gratifying. Okay. Self-gratifying. We're self-focused. We're self-idolizing. Now, over time, some of these things either come under control because we're trained or we're taught that those are inappropriate, right? But the tension still exists in our lives when we come face to face with moments that challenge that. Okay? When I don't get my way, what do? Well, why is it a problem? Because my way is the right way. Right? Because I'm king. Fair enough? Everybody with me on all of that kind of stuff? Okay. So what happens is Christ, and in the Christian world, we're saying that Christ is king. And if we say Christ is king, that threatens things for us. Because that means that I have to give up what? My own kingship. I have to give up my own authority over my life. I have to give up my own place of being able to determine what's right and what's wrong and what I get to do and what I don't get to do and, you know, what my day should even be like. I have to give that all up because I'm no longer the sovereign controller of my universe. I am now under the authority of the King of Kings. And if you want a little context for the King of Kings, read Colossians chapter 1, as it talks about why Jesus is capable of being the King of Kings. But so this threat comes along, and when we're being threatened, these things create fear when we're being threatened. Much like Herod, I'm afraid of what's going to happen if I don't have control in a particular situation, or if I can't follow my own desires. So there's some fear that wells up, okay? There's also fighting that goes on. Now, none of this is in your notes. So this is just all extra stuff, okay? The fighting goes on. It tells us in James chapter 4 that you argue and you complain and you fight and you kill and you destroy. Why? James chapter 4, because you covet and you don't get what you want. If I don't get what I want, then I do stuff in order to manipulate the situation to get what I want. Because I'm king. But the problem with all of that stuff is it just brings destruction into our lives. Brings loneliness. Think about Herod. All of that work to protect his kingship, what did he have left when he was all done? No family. No heir. Right? He eliminates them all. Nothing. And what do we remember him by? The wicked, nasty king who killed a bunch of babies. You know, the reality is when we pursue these types of things, that's what we get remembered by. The whole story of the Christmas Carol, right, is based upon that. Ebenezer Scrooge, self-seeking, self-glorifying, self-gratifying, at the expense of everybody else. The other thing that happens is, or it could happen here, is that you could fall into despair. So really, depending on how you're bent or how you work, you'd be a person that when your sovereignty of your own life is threatened, you could either fight or you could flee, really, which fleeing towards despair. Like, what am I going to do? How am I going to go forward? Life's the pits, you know, that kind of stuff. So what is it going to take for us to be able to make Christ king? Well, first of all, the Bible tells us this. The Bible tells us in Psalm 51, it tells us that God is not interested in sacrifices. What he's interested in is a broken and contrite heart. So the very first thing that it takes for us as we would consider making Christ our king is humility. Okay? It takes a humbleness. It takes coming and bowing down. Honestly, I feel like that's don't get me wrong, I like democracy. But as a group of people, not recognizing a king in front of us makes us miss that concept of what it means to bow down before somebody and kneel. You look at some of the cultures, if you've ever seen the movie, is it The Prince and I? Or read the book or whatever, right? It's a book. That's where the prince comes in and it's an American woman and an Indian prince, I think. Everybody with me? Nobody's tracking? Okay, anyways. Huh? The king and I. The king and I. Sure. Huh? Yeah. Yeah, right. Okay, so there's a scene in there, right? Where he walks in and the whole place goes, except her, right? If you've seen the movie. And then this creates this romantic attraction, blah, blah, blah. Okay. When I saw that for the first time, I thought, that's what it's going to be like when the King of Kings sets foot in front of all of people. And we don't understand that because I think we like to be sovereigns over our own space. There's humility there. There's a recognition of who we're dealing with. We're dealing with the King. So there's self-denial. I no longer get to pursue things based on my own desires and wants. I have to begin to pursue things based on what the king wants. What does the king want? I don't get a chance to really ask the question anymore, what do I want? What does the king want? What does the king desire? How do I live knowing that the king has better, bigger plans, right? And so it tells us this. This is the passage that you're supposed to read, right? For fertilizer this week in Mark chapter 3. These are my mothers and brothers and sisters, right? Who are they? The ones who do the will of God. The Lord's Prayer says this. It says that our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be your name. Your kingdom come, your will be done. Not mine, the king's. That's really hard. It's hard. This whole exposure of my own kingdom shows up in my home all the time. My kids expose that the most, okay? Because something they're doing is counter to my kingship of their home. And I sometimes forget that I'm really not the king of the home. Christ is the king of the home, and I'm just an ambassador to his leadership over my own children. Right? So it goes on, self-denial, living sacrifices. Romans chapter 12, verse 1 and 2 talks about that, that we should no longer be conformed to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of the mind. Our verse 1 says, in view of God's mercies, offer yourselves as living sacrifices. Okay, anyways, sorry, forgive my spelling. Okay, living sacrifices. This means every day I'm living in view of offering myself in the service of the King. The Knights of the Round Table, that was their whole thing. Hey, go out and fight wherever I tell you to fight, because I'm the King, and you'll go serve the kingdom and the purposes of the kingdom. What do I go do? Do every day, do I go out and do I go and say, today I'm going to serve the King of Kings? Or today I'm serving myself, and when things don't go my way, then I'm going to deal with those the way that I want to deal with them. It means being willing to love like Christ. And it means being an imitator of Christ. Ephesians chapter 4 talks about this. Imitate God, and therefore be imitators of God, dear children. And then it talks about loving like Christ. What does this produce in our lives? If we follow Christ as King and submit ourselves to His kingship, it will produce joy. Because I never have to be concerned about what's going on around me, because they're under the authority of the King. I don't have to be responsible for the problem that comes my way. I just have to be responsible for how I act in the midst of it. Does that make sense? Like, okay, I just blew a tire. This is all under the authority of the King. So now I get to respond knowing that the King's in charge. And I'm not dealing with Herod the king. That would be really awful. If I knew that the things I'm dealing with is under the authority of Herod the king, who's willing to kill babies, I don't like this. That's not who I'm serving, right? I'm serving the King of Kings, the Lord of Lords, the one who's been in place and positioned by God, the creator of the universe, who is good. That means the King is good. That means the King is actively working for the good of those who love Him and are called according to His purpose, Romans chapter 8. And so there's joy. It doesn't mean I'm like, maybe I don't have the exuberant great joy like when they saw the star, okay? But there's joy in knowing that I'm in the service of the King. There's peace. Pastor Phil talked about this a couple weeks ago when their water heater exploded all over their basement and drenched the place, right? There was peace in their life because in the service of the King. And then that produces in us an ability to love Christ as our King and depend on Him and to love others as well. When we look at this story that has been laid out for us beautifully, it's a gospel message, folks. The gospel message is this: turn your hearts to the King. Turn your heart to the King, and there will be more in store for you, abundant joy and abundant life that Christ has come to bring. But if you resist the King, if you fight against the King, if you try to fight for your own kingship, there will be a difficult and troubled journey in front of you. As you think about this, really, we get a chance to kind of wrestle through this. Even as Christians, as those who have accepted Jesus Christ as our Lord and Savior, this tension still exists today, all the time. Hear me? And Christ is at work refining those from us. And that is a beautiful thing to hear about. If you're not a believer in Jesus Christ today and you still are holding and clinging to your own authority and your own kingship, the end is destruction. The end of that will continue to bring pain. those that have believed in Jesus Christ, although that's being refined for us, the promise is we have been forgiven of all of our false allegiances. We've been forgiven against all of our hostilities against the King of Kings. There is no record of us fighting against him any longer because he shed his blood to forgive us of that. And under his rule and reign, we will live forever in the presence of God and the King. What a beautiful picture that is laid out for us as we look in the book of Matthew. You know, today is often a day when we make resolutions, right? Some of you probably have already thought about it. Oh, for this next year, I'm going to, whatever. I'm going to not drink a Coca-Cola for the whole year. Lie. Okay, but we come up with these things, right? And it's encouraged, like, it's part of the New Year's resolution thought process. Let me challenge you this morning to not worry about what you look like or what you eat, but begin to focus your attention upon how you live under the leadership of the King. So I'm going to give you a couple things. One, maybe you could be a seeker. Maybe it's time in your life where you need to begin to actively start seeking out the truths about what God has for your life. Once I know what the King wants, I can then live in response to that. If I don't know what the King wants, my ignorance will still spiral down to painful experiences. So spend time in God's Word. Become a seeker. Start looking and mining the depths and come up with ways to do that. If you don't know how to do that, that's what we're here for. That's what we long to do, is to help people to begin that process of adding this to your life. Be a worshiper. Like, worshiper in this context literally means to be a living sacrifice that no longer conforms to the pattern of this world, but is transformed by the renewing of your mind. Romans 12, 1 and 2. And so, be a worshiper who is no longer being conformed. Which, this means this. Everybody else responds that way. Not good enough. You're now under the leadership of the King. We're supposed to respond in love. Okay? Love is patient. It's kind. It's not rude. It's, you know, doesn't keep records of wrongs. It has that whole long list. And I tell you what, this is a struggle for, I think, every human being that exists out there, and every Christian continues to struggle down this road. But Christ will help us and enable us to be that. And when we commit ourselves to that journey, that leads us to worshiping him in a much more authentic way. So practice it. Practice loving somebody. I heard one person say just recently, next time you go to the grocery store, pick the longest line on purpose. And allow Christ to work internally. Because why do we avoid the long lines? Because it's a long line and the people in front of us are being stupid, whatever, right? Well, that's not very loving. That is definitely not conformed to the image of Christ. And if you entrusted yourself to that, maybe watch what God could do with your time in the line. Because my time's precious. Oh, wait, no. My time is the King's time. And finally, to be a servant. Will you resolve to be a servant this year? Seeking ways that you could put others before yourself. We want this. As parents, we teach our kids this, but yet we struggle with practicing it. We have to be intentional about it. We have to practice it. If we want any of this stuff to become natural in our lives, we have to practice it. We have to commit to it. It's just like making three free throws from the basketball court. You're not just going to show up and make a bunch of free throws in a row. You're going to have to go and practice those so that in the game time situation, it's ready to roll. You're ready to rock. This year, let's be servants of the Most High King. Let's get ready to rock by being seekers, worshipers, and servants of the King.